This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Lee Young Lee is an award-winning poet and former fellow of the Guggenheim Memorial Foundation and the National Endowment of the Arts. His latest collection of poetry, The Undressing, draws from work ranging from the Old Testament to Wu-Tang Clan. Clues to his creative impulse can be found in his autobiography, The Winged Seed, A Remembrance. In it, he shares the story of how his once powerful Chinese family became political exiles, a weight and history that he carries into his poetry. Lee Young Lee is in the Triangle for the debut performances of Speaking with the Universe. It's a production that combines Lee Young's poetry with the music of sitar player David Whetstone. Lee Young, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have
you
here.
Thank you, Frank.
I don't know where to start. Your family story is incredible. Let's talk a little about that, and then I want to talk about your poetry and your process. But your family was once very powerful and very well connected in China.
Yes. My mother's grandfather was the first president of the Republic of China. And he made himself emperor. He ruled as emperor for 100 days before he was poisoned and died. My father was a personal secretary to Mao Zedong, and they were traveling together on an air. A lot of people get the story mixed up. They say he was his personal physician, but that story comes from what happened on an airplane once. He was traveling with Mao. Mao got very sick and couldn't stop vomiting, and his physician couldn't stop him either, and my father somehow got him to stop vomiting, and he ended up laying his head in my father's lap, and they made the rest of the journey that way, and the inner sanctum of Mao's circle started calling him the personal physician, you know. So
very well connected in China, and then the family is sent into exile. What happens next?
Well, my father and Mao had a falling out. My father ended up having to flee for his life and took his family to Indonesia, where he was a teacher, a professor, and every so many years, a certain population of Indonesia kills off a bunch of Chinese, and my family got caught up in that. Sukarno at the time was rounding up Chinese and throwing them in jail. And at night, the local population, they were murdering Chinese. And so my father got thrown into jail and eventually escaped. Mm.
So you are born in exile in some ways, although in some ways you're not, obviously this is not part of your personal history. It becomes part of your family history.
Right. I was born in Indonesia, and I was about 2 years old when my father was thrown into prison. Mm-hmm. And we were being sent to a prison colony. Eventually, my father spent about 18 months in a leper colony. And the government there accused him of working with the United States government to bomb military installations, and that was totally bogus. But they eventually found him guilty, and they were having our whole family sent to a prison colony, and we escaped. I was about 4 years old, and we traveled. We were on the run. We escaped the boat and got to Hong Kong. And from Hong Kong, we went to Macau and eventually to Japan and Malaysia and then back to Hong Kong. And we've sought asylum in the United States.
So talk about that for you and settling in the U.S. and what that meant for you and your family.
Well, it's complicated, Frank. My father used to say to me, you know, people have been trying to kill me since I was born, which was pretty true for him. And certainly when I was born, somebody was trying to kill my father, the government and the locals, and we eventually were on the run. And when we came to this country was at that time at war with an Asian country, Vietnam. And at the time, you know, people couldn't tell the difference between a Vietnamese person and a Chinese person. So I was looked upon as the enemy, and a lot of that violence was directed toward myself and my family. And we grew up here, so it was a very fraught experience and under threat, and sometimes I think that that kind of experience of trauma maybe influenced my writing poetry, you know.
Well, where in the United States were you raised?
We spent a year in Seattle, yeah, and eventually spent 12 years in a small coal mining town in western Pennsylvania.
Oh, so talk more about that than this way in which the pathway to becoming a poet for you.
Well, maybe it's not as clear as I would hope. It does seem to me, I'll back up a little bit, Frank, and say this. I do think that poetry is a very radical form of counting. You know, you're counting syllables, you're counting words, you're counting line breaks, you're counting stanzas. There's a real ferocious counting going on in when you write poetry, and I think that leads to deciding what counts altogether, you know, what counts at all. And so this form of counting, I think I was forced into it. My father was a very religious person, very spiritual. My mother was very spiritual and continues to be a very spiritual human being. And the whole, I think the spiritual path is a form of, is a way to count and to ask ourselves what counts. And it seems to me that poetry is just naturally spiritual in that way. You're trying to decide what counts, because finally you're counting everything, syllables, accents, stresses, caesures.
You know? Well, the fascinating thing about counting, and I think this is what it really comes into play with good poetry, is that if you're counting stuff, you have to have the space in between the stuff to make the distinction between one,
right,
and zero, and then two and three and four. So each object has to have space around it in order to be a unique object to be counted.
Right.
In effect. So, and poetry is certainly consumed with the idea of silence, right?
Yes, absolutely. And this, you know, Frank, it dawns on me recently that silence is a human invention. It's a very profound, it's one of the great creations or inventions of humans. I don't think silence is natural. I think what's natural is this kind of murmuring chaos that is constantly in the background. Especially now, you know, given the internet, and we're just being just flooded with information, you know, advertising. So there's this constant murmuring. Sometimes it's a murmur, sometimes it's a roar, but it's just a form of chaos. And out of that chaos, I think art, and particularly poetry, has to create the silence in which to hear the words, you know. So that silence has to be created too. So silence and speech are, I think, intertwined in that way. And they're both a kind of human, I don't want to call it invention. It sounds too...
Well, I'd get into a tug of war with you over that one. I would say that's really a function of dualism. It gets back to what counting, how it does it. If I see, if I have the thing, then I have to have the not thing. And there has to be a series of opposites. And a human mind is the thing that invented that. I'm not sure that the rest of the universe cares about our inventions or our comparisons.
Yeah,
I doubt that the rest of the universe it would be amused if it had a consciousness that we've bothered to make these distinctions, in which we could find silence over and against the center.
Yeah. So I do think that human enterprise of creating this space in which to see something, if it's visual art, you know, it would be creating a space in which to see something. In poetry, it would be creating a silence to hear something. I do think that's human, and I think it's important to humans. I'm not sure it's important to the galaxy, you know.
So when you start right now, talk about this team that you built and this collaboration with David Whetstone, a sitar player.
Well, first of all, you know, David's an incredible sitar player. He's an incredible musician. I think he's, it's safe to say he's probably the best, if not one of the best sitar players in the West. You know, I think other sitar players would recognize that. But, you know, music is a form of counting, and it instills or it imparts or creates a form of listening, which is different than the listening or the silence in which, you know, maybe listening is that silence that poetry creates. But anyway, that poetry creates one kind of listening. I think music creates another kind of listening, another kind of silence, and another form of counting. And so I'm just so curious about the marriage of these two things, you know.
When did you meet, and when did that sort of moment happen for you?
You know, I heard him perform with Robert Bly and Coleman Barks, and I was just blown away. I could just feel that his music was really clearing a lot of ground in which Robert Bly's already gorgeous poems and Coleman Barks' translations of Rumi. David's playing was really creating a huge space, a really fecund potential space in which the words could be heard. And I just wanted to be a part of that. And we started working together a few years ago. And we've been practicing for a long time, trying to get that balance right. You know?
Well, I'd like to hear a little sample of the fruit of that collaboration. This is a clip from a piece called Little Bird.
Eye to eye, within the within. Hoping to keep you in sight, I find you have me surrounded as you flit, dart, and leap tree to tree, in and out, behind me, before me. Now glimpsed, now hidden, now vaulting into open blue, you are gone. The momentary seams you traced in the seamless, nowhere to be found.
A clip from Little Bird with David Whetstone on sitar, poetry of Lee Young Lee. Lee Young Lee is my guest. They will perform Friday night at the Durham Arts Council in an event called Speaking with the Universe. Poet Lee Young Lee, our guest today on The State of Things. So it's a lovely piece, but I have to ask you, because we were talking so much about the importance of silence in poetry, now we have a sitar that fills those silences.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating, Frank. The hardest thing for me is David's timing, because he's such an impeccable musician. His timing is so great, and I have had to learn to find the right time to jump in. So this sense of timing, my sense of timing has sharpened, and I have to find those pockets, you know. And I think if we are successful, when we are successful, there are larger silences created, but they're not as obvious as the pauses, you know, between, let's say, musical phrases or the pauses in a poem. There's a kind of deeper listening that, and if we think of silence as listening, maybe that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the better word. You know, I think this marriage of music and poetry, first of all, it's not new, right? It's old. It's the oldest thing we could be doing. David the psalmist was doing that, you know, and my aspiration is to write the psalms, you know, the new psalms. But I think this form of deeper listening, the listening, the silent listening that occurs in the listener, the reader, we're hoping to kind of unearth that, you know, make that habitable to the human ear. Make that a place where you can go to and inhabit and hear better.
You have brought your poetry and his sitar playing together. Do you ever collaborate and sort of write a poem with him at your side, or he plays with you at his side?
Yeah, very much so. Sometimes I just sit by while he plays, and I write, I read, I revise, and there's something about the playing that is just... I just find it really inspiring.
You've written an autobiography as well, and that for you apparently was therapeutic. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, that was actually very difficult for me, Frank. I think when one writes prose, for me, when you write prose, I think you assimilate your background differently than when you write poetry. In a poem, one's biography gets alchemized differently, you know, than when you're writing prose. So it was difficult, and I was kind of greedy about the information. I felt like once I wrote it in prose, I would never be able to, once it was made public, I wouldn't be able to keep it and let it alchemize into poetry. You know, it was kind of like the gunpowder got wet or something like that, you know. Yeah, but...
Well, how is it different? Is it different in the composition of as you're sort of putting it together as the words are coming to you, or does it have a different impact on you once they're out on the page? The difference between prose and poetry.
You know, prose writers are going to hate me for saying this, Frank, but I found that writing prose, the counting wasn't as obsessive. You know, I like obsessive counting. I don't know what psychoanalyst is going to do with that phrase, but I like obsessive counting, you know, and I don't think one is counting as ferociously in writing prose. And there's a lot more attention, I think, to, the prosaic and the facts of the autobiography, the background in a way, you know. And so it's this tension, I think, between in all art, figure ground, you know, the tension between the figure and the background. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot more attention to the background in writing prose. And I'm interested in the figure, its tension with the ground. And
Lee Young Lee is a poet. His Speaking with the Universe features the poetry of Lee Young Lee and David Whetstone on the sitar. That's tomorrow night at the Durham Arts Council. Going to be at Greensboro College Saturday night and at East Carolina University on October 30th. Lee Young, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hollab-Mormon, Robin Copley is our technical director, Josie Taurus, our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.